Hey everybody, welcome to Patriot to the Core podcast. This is episode number 3. I am Thad Forrester and I really appreciate you tuning back in with me. Before I introduce our first guest, Pastor Mike Dillman, I would just like to encourage you, if you haven't already read Mark's book, My Brother in Arms, please check it out. You can get it just about anywhere where books are sold, definitely Amazon, Books of Me and Barnes & Noble, and of course Mark's website, markaforrester.com. We recently just made a small change to the cover. We changed the font a little bit and lightened up the color. So mainly wanted it to stand out a little better, especially on a bookshelf, and especially that spine if it's stuck amongst a bunch of other books. So hopefully it's more easily seen. I noticed when I was at a friend's house, he had it on a shelf and I could hardly see it. And my mom said the same thing. So we hopefully solved that issue with the space that we have available on the book. Please check it out. If you enjoy it, please leave an honest review on Amazon also. But anyway, I'd like to introduce our guest, Pastor Mike Dillman. We met him first in 2012. He had our family out there for their Memorial Day event, and this is the largest Memorial Day event on the West Coast and quite possibly in the country. Very impressive the way they treated us and the way they honor all of our military, our veterans, those both, and the Gold Star families as well. So he's going to hopefully share with us how he started this huge event and his time in the military as well as a Vietnam veteran, how he came home to an ungrateful nation, traveling on a bus through Berkeley, California, how protesters stopped his bus and actually began rocking it. And I think he felt safer when he was deployed than he did sitting on that bus without a weapon. And so hope to get into all of that. He's a very powerful speaker and really just a great American. I'd like to just start out with, I know you just finished up your big Memorial Day event, so why don't you tell us about it?
Well, it was our 16th year to put on the event, an event that I think is one of the largest events in the nation to honor. Our purpose statement is to honor the veterans, remember the fallen, and tell our story to our young people. So that's our goal, and I think we did pretty good this year. The Memorial Day event reaches out to the 70 families, Gold Star families, within an hour's drive of where we live. And we call those the heroes in our own backyard. We have 7,000 across the nation, and 70 within an hour's drive of where we live. So we reach out to those 70 families in a very personal way, try to get as many of them there as we can. We still have families that tell us that on Memorial Day weekend they hide, they don't come out, and they try to get past that day as quickly as they can, as quietly as they can. But there's other families that find healing by coming out and seeing the crosses, 7,000 crosses. And then they have that opportunity, the families, of sharing the pictures and the stories of their young people, their husbands or sons or daughters. And then our citizens have an opportunity to embrace them and speak those words that are so healing. Thank you for your sacrifice, an extravagant gift for freedom. So that is the highlight of what we do. But we also have many other things. We do the USO show for entertainment. Unfortunately, if we don't do something that draws out the families, they won't come just to see crosses. Mm-hmm. So we put up a big, what we call the energy zone for the children. And we remind them that they're playing in the shadow of those crosses. And their play is permitted, by the freedom that is secured by the sacrifice of those men and women. So we try to connect those dots for people. The fireworks show we do at the in the evening is to welcome home the men and women that have returned safely to us. We celebrate that return. So we try to do everything we can throughout the day. We have helicopters that land, flyovers, and people just come out in droves. I think we had 35,000 people attend this year.
How many were you expecting?
We actually were expecting a little more, but I think that was because last year we had the Vietnam Memorial, which is an 80% recreation of the National Monument in Washington, D.C. That brought out a lot of people who will never get to Washington. So they came to see the Vietnam Memorial, and we probably had closer to 50,000 people last year. This next year, I'm working with an organization called Tunnels to Towers. It's about a fireman that ran from the tunnels to the towers on 9/11. And they've created a huge moving memorial that commemorates 9/11. And they have many different mementos inside of that tractor trailer that opens triple wide and creates a 1,000-foot historical museum of 9/11. We're also working with a group out of Akron, Ohio. They have a moving memorial also inside of a huge semi-truck. And their memorial commemorates the death of 12 men on a single day from a single unit in Iraq. These guys were from the Akron, Ohio area. And so we have that memorial coming this next year also. And then, of course, we have the memorial that we built that will be back in place for next year. So we're already planning.
Will you explain the memorial of yours? Because it's very impressive.
Yeah, the memorial of ours is 12 panels. Each panel has 6,000 names. So that rises close to the number of 7,000. That's the number we've lost since 9/11. And each panel highlights the story of one of our American heroes. Your brother is one of those stories that we tell. And when I saw your brother's story on coming home, I got involved immediately with the effort of finding your family and asking permission to put Mark on one of our panels and then allow us to be able to tell his story wherever we go. And I was granted that permission. And it led to my coming out to Haleyville and seeing what you folks do every year to mark the memory of Mark. On one of the other panels, we have a young lady by the name of Emily Perez. She was at West Point, and at the age of 21, she was an E-9, a command sergeant major at West Point. That's crazy.
Why is that crazy, Pastor?
Well, at the age of 21, I mean, men spend their entire lives in the military trying to rise to that level. And of course, I realize that E-9 status at West Point speaks of her student status. She was not an E-9 in the regular Army. But among her peers and there on the campus, she's an African-American girl. It's unprecedented. Her superior officer said she was presidential material. And Emily received orders to go to Iraq. At about the same time, she discovered that her friend was dying with kidney failure. And as fate would have it, Emily was a perfect match and was allowed to stay behind for 6 months so that she could have surgery to remove her kidney and donate it to her friend. And then Emily went on out to Iraq to command a combat unit. She wasn't there but just a day over 30 days, 31 days, and she was shot. The bullet went through the body armor in the only place where she was not protected. And she was shot in the heart and was killed instantly. So they have an organization, the Emily Perez Foundation in Vermont, and they give away hundreds of thousands of dollars every year to African-American young ladies who aspire in their studies in college. So Emily's life and memory goes on. Then there's Michael Mansour. He's a Navy SEAL from Garden Grove, California. He's the only boy that could have saved himself the day he died. His story is much like Mark's. Mark didn't have to run to the fight. He probably could have avoided his death by doing something differently than he did. Michael Mansour was standing beside a wall, a stone wall. All he had to do was fall to the ground and cover himself. But he ran to the fight, allowed his men to take cover, and Michael was credited with saving six Navy SEALs and was given the Congressional Medal in death. When they went to Michael's home to tell his parents that Michael had died in combat, Michael's dad had a stroke right there and has never recovered. He's bedfast from the day that he heard about Michael's death. So war not only does it take our loved ones, but in many cases it takes our tranquility, our peace, our bodies. And so I know how much your family has suffered. I really don't, but I have some idea of the suffering that continues.
Yeah, what you say is true, because my parents have never been the same. My dad is not an emotional man. I've seen him cry very few times in my life before the death of Mark, and now crying comes very easy. And my mom sleeps a lot more. I mean, it's really affected their emotional health, and it's been getting close to 6 years now, and it really hasn't gotten any better. So yeah, I see how it really affects the loved ones, especially. I've seen it with the parents for sure.
So that's our memorial. I mean, I could talk about some others, but there's 12 panels, 600 names on each panel, and it lights up at night. It's quite a display. I had the memorial set up in Coalinga, California, and that's a town much like Haleyville. There's only about 1,500 people in the town, and they wanted me to bring the memorial. I set it up for 3 days, and when we set it up, we don't leave it. We always have someone standing by to watch over it. And on this particular Saturday evening, it was really, really cold. It was in November, and I couldn't sleep. I left the hotel and went down to the memorial. It was about midnight. There were two older gentlemen, Korean War guys, that were bundled up watching the memorial, but nobody was there. And I told those fellas, go ahead and leave, and I would stay and watch the memorial. So I sat in the cab of my truck, and I wasn't there for very long when a young man drove up. He didn't see me, but I saw him. He got out of the truck, and he went to the memorial, and he went around it. He walked around the memorial completely and then stopped in front of a panel, and he reached up and it appeared to me that he was touching a name. And so I got out of my truck and went over to where he was at, and I engaged him. And I said to him, I said, did you know this boy? And he said, yeah, I knew him. Now, this kid was probably 19. He says, yeah, I knew him. And I said, well, tell me about him. He said, well, he was the runt in our high school. Now, this kid that I'm talking to, he's like 6'3", 6'4", weighs about 300 pounds. He's a big kid, good-looking kid, but big, strong. And he said, you know, I played football at Coalinga High School, and I was pretty a popular kid on campus. But this boy was the runt. He called him the runt in the high school. And he said, I made his life a living hell. And he said that if that's not bad enough, I encouraged other friends of mine to torment him. We mocked him, called him names, shoved him around. And then he said, I didn't know he would turn out to be my hero. And he said, I don't know what to do with this. He said, well, how do I fix this? And I said, well, I said, it's good that you're here. I'm glad that you're here. And I said, in a few moments, I'm going to leave so you can be alone with this kid. And I want you to talk to him. Tell him what you would say to him if you had the chance to say it to him in person. And I said, get that off your heart. And then I said, if you'll make a commitment to him that from now on, wherever you go, as long as you live, you'll speak out against bullying. I said, if you'll do that, this boy would have been proud. He would have been happy to lay down his life for you. And with that, I said, I'll leave you alone. And I went and got in the truck. He was there for probably the better part of an hour when he got in his truck and drove away. So we've seen the memorial, the impact it has on people, especially on children and young people. You know, when you see names, when you see crosses, it reminds me of the story of Moses when they crossed over in the Red Sea. And after the children of Israel were on the other side, Moses said to Aaron, take three rocks and pile them up, one on top of the other, so that from now on, when our children pass this way, and they say to their parents, what meaneth this? You can tell them that is a memorial to the day when God opened up the Red Sea. So there's a story behind those three rocks. And there's a story behind every one of those names and every one of those crosses. So when we bring the children out to Memorial Day weekend and the young people, it is our prayer that before the day is over, they will say to their moms and dads, what do those crosses mean? What did those panels mean? And the parents have a job and a duty to say to those children, what those mean is that somebody laid down their life and gave every drop of blood they had to make it possible for you to come out, eat a hot dog, bounce around in these houses, and breathe the sacred air of freedom. It's sacred, really. Yeah. The air we breathe is sacred.
Yeah, that's powerful.
That's what the memorial is, and that's why we do it.
Well, what about the, you know, I've been there to your Memorial Day event in 2012. We were there for the entire weekend. We witnessed firsthand the support from the community. You seem to have a lot of support from not only just the people, but also from businesses. I mean, why is it that I realize I'm an outsider and things may appear to be different than they really are, but why is Manteca such a patriotic community?
Well, you know what? I've asked myself that question on many occasions because it's not that way in other communities. I think it starts with our leadership, our mayor and members of our city council. Most of them are veterans. Some years ago, probably 10 years ago, the city of Manteca raised up, I think it was around $25,000 that they raised up to buy 2,400 beautiful flags. And then they hired a contractor to go through the city and every 10 feet drill a hole in the concrete so that we could put those flagpoles in the ground. And 16 times a year, citizens meet to create the team that goes throughout the city to place those 2,400 flags. And every one of those flags has the name of an American hero on it, a son or a daughter that has served, a veteran. And then they do that at 4 o'clock in the morning. And then they come back at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, go back out and retrieve them, fold them up, put them away. They just did that yesterday on the 14th of June on Flag Day. And they'll do it again on the 4th of July. And they'll do it 16 times throughout the year. So it turns our flag in our city into it's a red, white, and blue city in a way that you'd have to see it to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
They've taken the side of a building. You know, there's a building in our town that used to be Turner's Hardware Store back in the 50s and 60s. Turner's Hardware Store was a big name in our valley. And they've since closed down. But on the side of that hardware store was the names of all of the men that served in World War II from Manteca. And over the years, that sign weathered and rotted away. So now what they've done is they've taken the side of that building and they've created space for five murals. Now, these murals, if you can imagine, are 20 feet wide and 30 feet tall. That's 600 square feet.
That's huge.
Of a hand-painted mural. And they've raised the money. Each mural has cost about $50,000. And they, every Memorial Day, they dedicate a new mural. And they've dedicated the World War II mural. They've dedicated the Korean War Memorial mural. And they've dedicated the Vietnam Memorial, and this next Memorial Day they'll dedicate a memorial to the Iraqi and Afghanistan war heroes. So when they're done, they will have spent $150,000 painting five murals on the side of the building at the corner of Main and Yosemite, the most trafficked corner in our city. So that's crazy. I mean, that people would give that kind of money, work that hard. They search nationally for an artist. They ask the artist to submit in writing why they would want to be chosen as the artist to do the mural. And so they've chosen artists from around the country who get paid well to do this. And it's just another one of those things that we do in our city. When I go around in the Memorial Day weekend and solicit money, I get tons of help. It's not unusual for people to write me a check for $5,000 to help me put on this event.
Wow.
I had one man this last year, I had one company donate 10,000 hamburger patties.
Good grief. Wow.
10,000 hamburger patties.
Well, you know, in addition to me being there, our family being there in 2012, we were just out there for your evening of honor in early April. And so once again, my wife and I realized, like, wow, they don't do anything halfway in Manteca, at least nothing that you're associated with, Pastor Dillman. And that was a fantastic evening, dinner and auction and everything that went along with that. And then the next day I went to the VFW post in Manteca. And it was a beautiful Saturday. Great weather, and I was amazed at how many people were there. They played a video from the night before. Mark Ozgeist from 13 Hours had spoken, and so people there got to see him speak from the night before, and then I spoke for a few minutes. And the support that I received from so many after it was over, I brought some books and Mark's book, My Brother in Arms, and I said, look, I'm not taking these back with me. I couldn't get them on the plane anyway. And I was just donating them. But this line formed and people started giving me money for the books. I said, no, these are yours. Please take these as a donation. And they wouldn't. They started giving me money for them. And I ran out of books and people still were giving me money. So yeah, there's something out there in that area that definitely more than just in the water. It's a great, great community. I mean, we have loved visiting there the two times we've been. There were two stories that kind of really intrigued me about some of your guests that you've had. Well, yeah, the guests this past year, I think you had, one of them is Earl the Pearl. I'd like you to maybe talk about him because he seems to have a very interesting story. And then also Rosie the Riveter, if I said that correctly.
Well, that Rosie the Riveter, you know, she stole the show this past year. You know, Rosie the Riveter is an affectionate name that was given to those women by the thousands whose husbands and sons went to war, and they went to the factories and they riveted together the ships and they built the tanks. And they turned our factories into war machines to support the men on the front lines. Without them, we could not have won the war. And this particular gal by the name of Mary Torres, 94 years of age, she behaves like she's 50. She spent the whole day out there. And I mean, I'm talking about the whole day. And it was a warm day this last year, but she didn't want to go anywhere. The people loved on her. You've seen the poster of Rosie the Riveter, lady with the bandana and her arm cocked up, showing her muscles with the slogan, "We can do it." That was the gal that we had come out. And there's a Rosie the Riveter museum that she goes to on a regular basis to engage the public and talk about that war effort and what those women did. And having her there this year was just amazing. And the people just, they wanted pictures with her. We had one of our merchants, Freedom Smog, in fact, Christina, the young lady that's helping me tape this right now, owns that smog shop. And she hosted Rosie the Riveter, and she created a backdrop where people could actually put on a bandana and put on a Levi jacket and put their arm in the air and take a picture and pose like they were Rosie the Riveter. And that was a big draw this year. People just loved loving on her, and she loved being loved on. And what was interesting, you know, Phil Waterford, the Ford dealer out here, a big supporter of what we do. And we gave away that car. We always give away a car in that Sunday evening meeting. And Phil came to the stage and he gave away the car. And then after he gave away the car, Phil's very close to many of the players on the Warriors team, mm-hmm. Warriors basketball team. And Phil goes to all the games, even if they're out of town, he travels to Cleveland or wherever to be with them. And so Phil, after he gave away the car, he said, I want to do something really special tonight. I want to take Rosie the Riveter to the Warriors game tomorrow night. And so he picked her up in a Rolls Royce, took her over to the Coliseum, And Phil said it was so amazing because for the first time he had ever seen this, people were not asking for the autographs of the players. They were around Rosie the Riveter and asking for her autograph. In fact, the players were asking for Rosie's autograph. And she was a real hit that night, and the players just loved on her. So she had quite a weekend, and we've become very good friends with Rosie.
Well, Phil mingles with the players. Yeah, he's on the floor. He's probably eating with them before the game or with their family. So, yeah, she definitely was very close to the players that game. Wow, that's funny.
Yeah, they play again tonight. And I don't know if she'll be there, but she talked to the coach of the Warriors. And she told the coach several things she thought he should know about how he could win this championship. And he responded to her and said, you know, I think you're good luck. I want you in another game of this series. And she put her finger in his face and said to the coach, said, now, I'm going to hold you to that. And I don't want those tickets coming from Phil Waterford. I want them coming from you. So he said, you can count on that. So I don't know if she'll be at that game tonight or not. But, you know, the other man you mentioned was Earl the Pearl. And Earl passed away in October. This is the first year that since we met Earl that he was not able to be with us. His wife was at the Evening of Honor, but Earl had passed away, and he was the last living member of the Negro battalion. Two battalions in World War II made exclusively up by what they called the Negroes. And they called them the Negro battalions. Our troops were segregated back then. And so for many years, they had a reunion for those that lived through that ordeal. And every year, that number who came together got smaller and smaller until only there was left Earl Watson. Earl passed away with cancer. But when Earl came home from the war, he wanted a job. And the Army wanted to give him a pension. They told him that a black man didn't have much of a chance finding a job. So they wanted to give him a pension for a couple years after he separated from the Army. He said, no, he didn't want their pension. He wanted a job. So he went job hunting, and he went to Hollywood, and he was hired on to be the men's room attendant at the Knickerbocker Hotel, which was the elite hotel of the 40s and 50s. And so his job was to be in the men's room and to clean the toilet after every use and to hand the patron a warm towel and make sure that his needs were taken care of in the men's room. Well, imagine this, that Ronald Reagan was in the stall with the door closed. So Earl, he said, what have you been doing? Earl said, well, I just got back from the war. Ronald Reagan said, the war? What'd you do in the war? He said, well, I fought at the Battle of the Bulge. I fought at the Rhine River. I fought on D-Day. And I said, I got 3 Purple Hearts. I'm happy to come home. And so when Ronald Reagan was done, he flushed the toilet and he said to Earl after he came out of the stall, don't touch that toilet. He said, you're too good a man to clean up after me. He said, you come with me. So they went upstairs to the bar, and Earl says in his book that John Wayne and Gene Autry were there drinking at the bar with Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan asked for the owner of the Knickerbocker. And when he came to the bar, Ronald Reagan said to the owner, he said, do you know who this man is? He said, yeah, that's Earl. He works in the men's room. And Ronald Reagan said, no, he's not Earl, the man in the men's room. He's a damn war hero. He just got back from the war. And you can't leave him in the men's room. You got to give him a real job. Or he said, John and Gene and I, we'll go somewhere else and drink, but we're not going to drink here. And so the Knickerbocker owner said to Earl, So Earl, what do you want to do? And Earl said, I want to be the doorman. So for 16 years, he was the doorman. And he met everybody. He knew personally Elvis Presley and Marilyn Monroe and Muhammad Ali, who just passed away, and Joe DiMaggio, and whoever visited Hollywood, whoever went to the Knickerbocker, they knew Earl. When Earl retired from there 16 years later, the mayor of Hollywood put on a big dinner to honor Earl and called him Hollywood's most important citizen. And so we just were so honored to know Earl. And, you know, Earl every year would send us a lot of money. I don't even know where he would get his money, but he would call and say, send me 30 tickets. And they're $100 a piece. Or he'd say, I want to buy a table at the Evening of Honor for next year. In fact, he said, I want to buy two tables. And he'd send me a check for $1,000. And before he passed away, he gave me a check for $10,000 and said, I want you to use this money to continue telling your story. And I promised him that wherever I went, people would hear about Earl the Pearl. And I go into schools, hold high school and middle school assemblies, and I tell these stories about Mark Forrester. I tell these stories about Emily Perez and Michael Mansour and Earl Watson. And when I'm done, people are in tears. And students listen to me very, very carefully. They're not getting it in the school. These stories aren't being told in the school. The folks that run the schools these days, they don't have a whole lot of interest in the things that we do, but the students are hungry to hear it, and we're happy to tell the story.
Well, let's talk about your story. I mean, I'd like to, you know, you're a Vietnam veteran, and I'd like you to talk about why you started this big Memorial Day event in Manteca and kind of explain your experience in the military and your, and then after military life.
Yeah, you know, Thad, my story is just one of millions of stories. We get ourselves in a situation where we have to wear the uniform, the cloth of our nation. I was in college and ran out of money, and that caused me to have to go and report to the draft board that I was no longer a student, and as such, I became eligible for the draft. And right away, I was told that my number was very low, that I would be drafted within days. And I didn't want to be drafted. I felt like if I was going to serve, I wanted to be my decision. So I went and joined the Army. And I figured that I would join the Army and maybe have some say about what I would do in the military. And so I signed up to become a chaplain's assistant and was chosen to do that. I went to chaplain school and I graduated with 35 other young men. And all of us went to Vietnam except one guy. And he went to Germany. So here I am, 12,000 miles away from home, and 13 and a half months I served in Vietnam, and our chaplain, the chaplain that I served with, was a gung-ho airborne trooper. And so I became his bodyguard, and I became his assistant. And we would go by helicopter and hitchhike when a helicopter was taking off and heading to a fire base camp. We would jump on board and get dropped off and spend 3 days, 4 days, a week in that camp where the chaplain would hold services and move around and meet the guys. And at night, when the chaplain would retire, I would pull guard duty or become one of the guys in protecting the base camp. And that's what I did for 13 and a half months. On occasion, our chaplain would have what's called a grave duty, where he would go to the morgue. We had two morgues in Vietnam. One was in Tan Sanut Air Base. That was the main morgue. It was an Air Force facility. The other one was in Cam Ranh Bay. And we at the height of the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq, we were losing 600 men a year. When I was in Vietnam, we were losing 600 men a week. And they would bring them in faster than you could process them. And inside that morgue, there were times when they were stacked up like cordwood. And the chaplain and myself would help to spread out the body bags. And our chaplain wanted to what he called touch the flesh, and render the last rites, commend the heart, the spirit of a fallen soldier into the hands of God. And so we would unzip the body bag. The chaplain would with all sincerity and tenderness, pray over that man and give him to God. Sometimes there was a body, sometimes there was just body parts. And we did that probably an average of once every 3 weeks, probably 20 times in my tour. We pulled that kind of what was called grave duty. Then I would go back to the office and create a letter, type a letter to the next of kin. The chaplain would sign it, and we would send it off to the to this hero's mom or dad or family or wife, and say that today, Chaplain Russell was with your fallen son, and we commended his spirit, his soul, into the hands of God. And so this became something that we did on a very regular basis. That's the kind of thing I encountered several firefights and got personally involved in combat. People ask me if I was responsible for killing people. I don't know. When you're in a firefight, you just fire what's out in front of you and hope you can live through it. So, you know, I don't know. I know that that's not what bothers me. What bothers me is those young men in those body bags. And that's left me with an impression on my soul that I don't think I will ever outlive. And I've been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm 70% disabled with that condition. And I go to VA. I try to get there once a week so that I can be with other men. It helps me to be with other men and talk with them, and they talk with me, and talking it out is good for the soul. If you bury it, I buried it for many years, and it was of no value to me. So once I opened up my heart, for many years I didn't speak of anything. You know, when you come home from Vietnam, we're 10 minutes from landing, maybe 20 minutes from landing in Seattle, and the President Nixon comes on the screen and thanks us for our service, and then says to us, as your commander-in-chief, I'm giving you the order to remove your uniform before you venture out to go home. And that's an order that I obeyed, but looking back on it, I wished I would not have obeyed that order. He said that the environment in the country is not favorable to returning veterans, and that it would be in our best interest to fade away into the community. And so we had to travel. We landed in Sacramento and then traveled from Sacramento to Oakland on buses, convoys, a convoy of buses. When we passed through Berkeley, California, the students were protesting the war, and they had knowledge of when these buses were coming through. And when our convoy passed, there hundreds of students flooded the freeway and stopped the traffic and surrounded our buses. And they were screaming obscenities. They were throwing feces, and they were rocking the bus that I was on and other buses as well. I had the sensation that they were trying to turn the bus over. And all I could think about is, less than 24 hours ago, I had an M16 in my hand. And now I'm back home. And I feel more threatened at this moment than I did when I was in Vietnam. At least in Vietnam, I could defend myself. And in that situation, we were defenseless. So until the police arrived and we got help to dissipate the crowd, move on so we could discharge from the military. Now, that's the kind of thing that drives me. That's the passion behind what I do. And I made up my mind that day that whenever Memorial Day rolled around, that I would find veterans. In that day, it was Vietnam veterans. I would find veterans, and I would bring them to where I was at and feed them, and we would embrace them. We would thank them for their service, and we would promise that they would never be forgotten. And I think we've been true to that mission. And now with the new generation of warriors, these kids that are coming home from the Middle East, they're getting honor. They're being treated well. I see them in restaurants and coffee shops, and it's not unusual for people to pick up the tab or go up to them and thank them for their service. And they wear that uniform proudly, and I'm pleased that they do. So I feel like the work that we do is important, and we're just going to keep on doing it.
Yeah. Well, how did the PTSD and the effects of the war affect your family life, Pastor?
Well, to be very honest with you, it was something that I kept hidden in my heart for many years. My wife would say to me, "What's wrong with you?" The nightmares, the physical effect on my body, constipation, abdominal pain. Many times in the night I would just faint from the pain. And my wife would want me to go to this doctor and that doctor. "What's wrong with you?" Well, what was wrong with me was that I was reliving the war every night when I would go to sleep, which is why I never tried to go to sleep before midnight, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. Sleep was my enemy. If I laid down and closed my eyes and entered into rest, that's when hell was the worst for me. So not getting a lot of sleep was very common for me. And we went through this for years until one day she said to me, this was in 1995, she said to me, "I can't live like this anymore. If you don't get some help, I'm gonna leave you." She said that through tears. And but she said, "I can't live like this." I was very good to my kids. I wasn't unkind or mean to my children or to my wife. I was just under a great deal of pressure and a great deal of trauma, and it created that upheaval. And so that's when I had to go get help. That's when I went to the VA and they told me, "Hey man, you're not alone. this is a problem that many of our veterans are dealing with, and but unless you come out, unless you put it on the table, we can't help you. So that's when I made the decision to do that, and the VA has been very good to me. I know that there's a lot of complaints across the country about the VA, but for me, I have no complaints. They've been very, very good to me. They take good care of me. They call me and check on me. And, yeah, so I think a warrior is never the same. I tell people I went to war when I was 19. I came home at the age of 119. Life for me changed forever. And that's the way it is for these warriors. They come home and life is never the same for them. We owe a debt we can never repay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're definitely a patriot to the core, Mike Dillman. And in closing, I'd like to maybe highlight, you're in Mark's book, My Brother in Arms. We talk about you and your event a little bit. Will you explain what stood out about Mark and why you chose him to be on one of your panels and to have us out there at your event?
Well, I'm minding my own business watching television, and this story comes on. I told you that we've opened the body bags of hundreds of fallen soldiers. Hundreds, probably thousands. We're losing 600 men a week in Vietnam. And so over the course of 13 months, you see them in body bags. You also see them out in the field. There are many guys that we saw fall in the field and helped to load onto helicopters. One of the first things we do is we strip their clothes off. We search for where they're bleeding. We search for where they're hit, so that we can address that problem. So it's not untrue for me to say that I've seen the bodies of hundreds of warriors, living and dead, and I've never seen one who had wrapped himself with the flag. That was what captured my heart in the story of your brother. For a guy to go to battle, I mean, we're talking 115 degree weather. We're talking about 40 pounds of body armor, 50 pounds of body armor. And I saw pictures of him the day he was in that battle that killed him. He not only had on body armor, he had a lot of other weighty kinds of equipment that was strapped to his body. He probably had 75, 80, 100 pounds of equipment on 116-degree weather. And the last thing a guy wants to do is add anything to his body. So when they took Mark's clothes off and they discovered that he had wrapped himself in the flag, I was blown away. I couldn't get that image out of my mind. And that's what really caught my attention. And that's the kind of story that needs to be told all across America. So his story is unique. And I know Colonel Latt, Lieutenant Colonel Latt, that was flying above and providing cover for him. I mean, he was so moved by the story. He flew a flag to your hometown in Haleyville. And I can only imagine what that must have been like the day he landed that war machine in Haleyville, Alabama. It's probably never been done before. And it probably was quite the sight. And then to get out of his airplane and walk, when he was offered a ride, he chose instead to walk and present a flag to your parents. That was also a part of the story that I couldn't get over. And all of it together, all the components together, created a historical event in the life of this nation that cannot be and must never be forgotten. I love his story. I wish I could have. I wish I could have held your brother. I wish I could have known him. I think when I see you, I see your brother.
Well, the first time that Colonel Latt and I spoke on the phone to arrange this whole meeting with Lifetime, and the first thing he said was, actually he paused and he said, "Whoa, you sound just like your brother." And you remember, he had never met Mark, but he had talked to him on the radio. So, of course, that it set him back for a minute and caused pause, but then it did me as well, because we do sound alike, and many people think we look alike. So, and I'm proud of that. I enjoy hearing that. But we're coming up on an hour, Pastor Dillman, and I really, really appreciate your time. It's been very moving to me. And I hope the listeners feel the same way. You really are. You have gone above and beyond for so many years with just service to others, to recognize our heroes and the Gold Star families. And me, as a member of a Gold Star family, I mean, really, really appreciate how you've treated us and how you treat all the others throughout the country. Anything in closing you'd like to say?
Well, I just I feel like I'm part of your family. I feel like you and your mom and dad are very, very dear friends of ours. And I regret that we're divided by so many miles, but we love you folks. And we can't thank you enough as a family for the sacrifice you have made. We have to stop and remember that Mark didn't have to do what he did. He didn't have to go. He didn't have to volunteer. He didn't have to become a combat controller. He didn't have to do anything that he chose to do. But by his own choosing and out of his own mouth, he made it known that he felt God had put him here for such a time as this. And so all I can say is, may the memory of your brother and may the passion of his heart rise to the surface across this nation at a time right now that we most need it. And I just pray that his death was not in vain, that leadership will rise up across America that will take on this fight head on, so our children and grandchildren will have a shot at life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah. Amen. Well, thank you, sir. This has been a great hour with you, and I hope it's been uplifting for you as well. And we'll keep in touch, and hopefully we'll get to see you again in Manteca, which is the most patriotic city in the country, in my opinion. We'll see you hopefully out there again soon. Is there anything in particular that you would like for me to say or to type up in the notes to describe you, to introduce you? In the text,
you know, it would just it would be an honor to be introduced to your audience as a man who loves his country and as a man who is devoted to making sure that our posterity remains free. I wish they would let us go again. I wish they'd let us old guys put on the uniform again, because we would we'd go in a heartbeat and defend this motherland for the sake of our loved ones.